Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today, well, it's to get you that fast, expert-level understanding on a topic that's everywhere but often unseen until something goes wrong. Hazardous materials.
Yeah, hazmat. It's definitely a field where you don't want to learn things the hard way, you know? The sources define it pretty clearly. Any substance or material that could pose an unreasonable risk to health, safety, or the environment.
And that risk comes during transport, incorrect use, or if it's not stored properly. It's not just like cartoonishly bubbling liquid.
Oh, not at all. It covers a huge range of things shipped across the country constantly.
Exactly. So today we're going to unpack the systems around these materials, the rules, how to spot them, the protective measures, basically give you a shortcut to being really informed on the emergency response side.
Right. And you kind of have to start with the rules, the regulations, because it's complex. In the U.S., there are three main federal players setting the stage.
Ah, yes, the alphabet soup. We hear about OSHA, DOT, EPA. How do they split up the responsibilities here?
It's actually a pretty logical split. OSHA, that's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They're focused on the worker.
Mm-hmm.
The people handling stuff, the responders.
Right, worker safety. Makes sense.
Then you've got DOT, Department of Transportation. Their focus is the material in transit. On the roads, rails, waterways.
Got it. While it's moving.
And finally, EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. They handle the environmental side, cleanup, waste disposal, long-term storage impacts.
Worker, transit, environment.
Yeah.
Clear enough. And OSHA gives us that key training framework, right? Hazy Whooper.
Exactly. Hazardous waste operations and emergency response. It lays out five core training levels.
Five levels. Awareness is the first.
Yep. Awareness. Then operations, technician, specialist, and incident commander. But the awareness level is interesting because it's for almost everyone who might encounter something first.
So what does awareness actually mean you can do?
It means you need to be able to recognize that hazardous materials might be present, understand the potential immediate dangers, know how to identify the substance if possible, and crucially, know your role.
Which is often.
Usually. Recognize, retreat, and report. Call for the higher levels of training. You don't need to be the hero, just the smart first eyes on scene.
Okay, so the big takeaway is that there are rules for use, storage, transport, but sometimes, well, things go wrong.
And that's when you shift from regulations to reality, to what you can actually see, smell, or sense at an incident. Safety becomes immediate.
Right, so let's jump into that. You're approaching an unknown scene, maybe that tanker rollover we mentioned. You need a high index of suspicion, but what's rule number one?
Your own safety, always. Sources hammer this home. You might not know all the hazards right away. So scene size up has to be cautious.
What are those immediate clues, the things that shout hazmat?
Visually, you're looking for maybe a visible cloud, weird-looking smoke or vapor, an obvious leak or spill.
Anything else? Sensory cues?
Oh, yeah. Smell is a big one. An unusual, strong, maybe noxious or acrid odor. Definitely a warning sign. And then you have the placards, labels, shipping papers, SDS sheets. The documentation clues.
But you mentioned something critical earlier, the human indicators.
Yes, this is key. If you roll up on a scene and find multiple people, more than one, collapsed, unconscious, having trouble breathing.
That's not typical for a standard car crash.
Exactly. That screams potential chemical exposure. A chlorine leak, for example, causes widespread breathing problems fast. That's your aha moment.
The huge clue. So what's the immediate action protocol then?
Stop immediately.
Yeah.
At a safe distance. And the mantra is upwind and uphill. Always try to be upwind and uphill from the incident.
By uphill.
Because many hazardous vapors are heavier than air. They'll sink and float downhill into low areas. So uphill gives you an advantage.
Okay, upwind, uphill. Then what?
Rapid scene size up from that safe spot. Isolate the area, keep others out. If you realize you somehow got too close, get out. Immediately.
And once you've secured the perimeter,
call for help. Provide as much information as you possibly can to dispatch. And then you wait. You do not go back in until the specialized hazmat team clears it. Period.
Okay, so calling for help means providing identification. That brings us to the systems, the main tool for first responders.
That's the DOT's Emergency Response Guidebook, the ERG. Every emergency vehicle should have one. It's non-negotiable.
And what does the ERG give you?
It's like the decoder ring. You find the placard number or the material name, look it up, and gives you specific properties, what the hazard is, and crucially, recommended isolation distances. How far back to set your perimeter.
So it tells you how big the danger zone might be?
Precisely. It's your immediate safety guide. And DOT organizes all these potential hazards into just 9 broad chemical families or classes.
9 classes. That seems manageable. What do they cover?
Everything, really. Class 1 is explosives. Class 2, gases flammable, non-flammable, toxic. Class 3 is your flammable and combustible liquids, like gasoline.
What about the more specialized stuff?
Yeah, you've got Class 7 for radioactive materials, Class 8 for corrosives, acids, bases, and then there's Class 9, miscellaneous.
Miscellaneous. Sounds like a catch-all.
It kind of is. It covers hazards that don't fit neatly elsewhere, but are still dangerous during transport. The big one these days, lithium batteries. That's often Class 9.
Okay. So that Class 9 placard signals a modern, maybe tricky hazard. How do we see these classes indicated in the field? You mentioned placards.
Right. Placards are those diamond cape signs you see on all 4 sides of a truck or rail car. They identify the general hazard class for the whole load.
Like flammable liquid, the big picture.
Exactly. Labels, on the other hand, are smaller. They go on the individual packages or boxes inside the truck. They refer only to the contents of that specific box.
Got it. Placard for the truck, label for the box, and there's paperwork, too.
Always. Bill of lading, waybill, air bill, shipping manifest.
Mm-hmm.
There should always be documentation identifying the specifics. At fixed sites like factories or warehouses, you'd look for safety data sheets, SDSs.
And if all else fails, or you need expert advice,
you call ChemTrek. It's a 24/7 resource center with a massive database on chemicals.
What do you need to tell ChemTrek?
You need specifics. The chemical name or UN number, if you have it, exact location, type of container, what the vehicle markings say, who you are, a callback number, good info in equals good advice out.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's shift gears a bit to the science, the physics, and toxicology. Knowing the chemical is one thing, but knowing how it behaves, that's critical.
Absolutely. How it moves, how it hurts people. There are a few key physical properties we need to understand. First up, vapor pressure.
Vapor pressure. Sounds technical.
It just relates to how fast a liquid evaporates. High vapor pressure means it turns into a gas or vapor really quickly once it's spilled. Liquids with low flash points usually have high vapor pressures.
Okay, so it dictates how quickly the air becomes hazardous.
Exactly. Which leads directly to vapor density. This one's super important.
What's that?
Vapor density compares the gas to air. If it's greater than 1, the vapor is heavier than air and it will sink. Collect in low spots, basements, ditches, subways.
And if it's less than 1?
It's lighter than air, it'll rise and dissipate more readily. This completely dictates your evacuation strategy. Heavy gas. You evacuate low areas, light gas. Worry more about upper floors initially, but it might spread out faster.
Wow, okay. That distinction heavier or lighter than air is huge for responder safety and telling people where to go.
Massive. Then you have flash point. That's the lowest temperature at which a liquid gives off enough vapor to ignite momentarily to flash.
So lower flash point means easier to ignite.
Yep. Highly flammable. And finally, specific gravity. This is like vapor density, but for liquids in water.
Does it sink or float?
Exactly. Specific gravity less than 1, it floats on water. Greater than 1, it sinks. Crucial for skills near waterways dictates your containment strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Floating stuff needs booms on the surface. Sunken stuff is a whole different cleanup nightmare.
Okay, vapor density for air, specific gravity for water. Got it.
Now, the toxicology side, how it actually harms you.
Great. The core idea is the dose effect principle. Simple concept. The longer you're exposed or the higher the concentration, the worse the effect on your body. Makes sense. And we measure acceptable levels.
We do. There are terms like TLV, threshold limit value, that's for long-term day-after-day exposure limits, and still, short-term exposure limit. These are more for workplace safety guidelines.
But in an emergency, there's one acronym that really matters, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. IDLH, immediately dangerous to life and health.
That sounds about as serious as it gets.
It is. IDLH is the atmospheric concentration of a substance that poses an immediate threat to life, or could cause irreversible health effects, or would impair someone's ability to escape from that atmosphere.
So if you're in an IDLH zone,
you need the absolute highest level of respiratory and skin protection, usually level A, and you're on borrowed time. It basically defines the boundary, the hot zone, where only properly equipped hazmat techs can operate.
Understood. Let's talk containers then, because they're often the first visual clue. The sources mention different types, drums, bags, cylinders, but they bust one myth, right?
They do. Drum color means nothing. You absolutely cannot assume what's inside based on the color of the drum. Blue, white, red, doesn't matter. You need the label or the SDS.
Good myth to bust. Okay, what about bigger storage?
You see everything from huge fixed tanks underground or horizontal, holding millions of gallons, down to totes.
Totes?
Yeah, they're intermediate bulk containers, often plastic cubes in a metal cage, holding maybe 100 to 700 gallons, quartable, and intermodal tanks, two big cylinders in a frame, designed to be moved between ships, trains, trucks.
But for immediate recognition on the highway, those tanker trucks are key. Their shape tells a story.
Definitely. The design often signals the type of hazard inside. Let's run through a few common ones.
Okay, hit me. Most common.
Probably the MC306 DOT406. That's your typical non-pressurized oval tanker. Smooth sides, usually shiny. Carries gasoline, diesel, heating oil, flammable liquids, around 6,000 to 10,000 gallons. Risk is mainly spill and fire.
Okay, standard fuel tanker. What about corrosives?
Look for the MC312 DOT412. The giveaway is the reinforcing rings around the outside of the tank, like ribs.
Ah, okay. Visible rings.
Yeah. Those are needed because it carries strong acids or bases. The rings add structural integrity.
Now, high pressure, things that could explode.
That's the MC331 pressure cargo tanker. Looks much more robust, often painted white, with rounded hemispherical ends, no flat ends.
Built like a tank because...
Because it holds gases under high pressure, maybe 300 PSI, propane, and hydrous ammonia. The danger here isn't just a leak. It's a potential BLEAV boiling liquid expanding vapor explosion. Very dangerous. Holds maybe 1,000 to 11,000 gallons.
Yikes. Okay. And the last one, cryogenics.
The MC338 cryogenic tanker. These look different, often have fittings and cabinets at the rear. They're basically giant thermoses. A tank within a tank with heavy insulation.
What do they carry?
Super cold liquids like liquid oxygen, liquid nitrogen, LNG. They operate at low pressure, but the hazard is the extreme cold and the massive expansion if the liquid warms up and turns back into gas.
So the shape of the tanker itself is a major clue. Once you know the hazard, or at least the potential hazard, it's about protection, PPE levels.
Right. Personal protective equipment. Levels A, B, C, and D. You need to match the level to the hazard.
Level A is the highest.
Yep. Level A is full encapsulation, gas tight suit, SCBA, self-contained breathing apparatus inside, maximum respiratory and skin protection for those IDLH environments or unknown high hazard situations.
And level D?
That's basically your standard work uniform. Maybe safety glasses, gloves. Use when there's little to no respiratory or skin hazard identified. Levels B and C fall in between, offering high respiratory protection, but less skin protection than A.
Okay. But before you even worry about treating anyone exposed, there's a critical step.
Decontamination.
Oh, yes.
Decon, it's absolutely vital. The sources distinguish between primary and secondary contamination.
Explain that.
Primary is getting the stuff directly on you. You walk through the spill, you get splashed. Secondary is getting contaminated from someone else or something else that was contaminated. Like a rescuer touches a contaminated patient without gloves, or contaminated equipment touches a clean surface.
And that secondary contamination is why Decon is so important before anything else.
Exactly. If the substance poses an unacceptable risk, and many do, Decon is the highest priority. You have to prevent spreading the hazard to responders, equipment, the ambulance, the hospital. Clean first, then treat.
Full stop. Decon first. What's the go-to for emergency Decon?
Water. Simple, effective, readily available. The sources call water the universal decontamination solution.
How is it applied?
For emergency Decon, it's usually about volume and speed. Removing the bulk contamination quickly, often a high-volume, low-pressure shower. For mass casualty incidents, they might set up a Decon corridor, maybe using fog streams from two fire engines, creating a tunnel of water spray for people to walk through.
Okay. Get the bulk off fast with water. Then, after Decon, treatment can begin.
Right. Treatment is generally supportive care, manage airway, breathing, circulation, but importantly, minimize invasive procedures if possible until you're sure Decon was thorough, and documentation is critical.
What needs to be in the patient record?
Everything. Describe the scene, what chemical you were told was involved, even if unsure, patient's initial condition and appearance, all treatments given, and any changes you observed. This info is vital for the hospital and long-term follow-up.
Makes sense. Finally, let's not forget the responders themselves, especially the hazmat entry team. They face risks beyond the chemical, right?
Oh, absolutely. Heat stress is a massive one. Wearing those level A suits is incredibly taxing physically. Plus, there's always the risk of some exposure to site the PPE. That's why medical monitoring is built into the process.
Monitoring before and after they go into the hot zone?
Correct. Before entry, they need a baseline assessment. Full vital signs, ECG, temperature, even body weight sometimes to track fluid loss.
And after they come out and get decontaminated?
Another assessment. Checking vital signs again, looking closely at hydration status, doing a neurological check coordination, fine motor skills, looking for subtle signs of toxic effects.
So it's a rigorous process to protect the protectors.
It has to be. And one last point on transport, never ever transport a patient who hasn't been adequately decontaminated.
Yeah.
Prepare the ambulance by removing unnecessary supplies, cover surfaces, and wrap the patient to minimize any lingering off-gassing or secondary contamination inside.
Right. That seems like a crucial final step. So this deep dive really shows how layered and structured the whole hazmat response world is, from identification to protection to cleanup.
It's all about protocols designed to manage that unreasonable risk we started with.
Okay, so key takeaways for your listening. Remember, vapor density, does it sink or rise in air? Specific gravity, does it sink or float in water? Those dictate movement. Always approach upwind and uphill.
And decontamination before treatment. Uh-huh. Always. Secondary contamination is a huge risk you have to control.
Definitely. Now, for final thought to leave you with, the source material mentions that fires, even simple structure fires, release toxic combustion products, things like carbon monoxide, cyanide compounds, formaldehyde, basically chemical asphyxiants.
Yeah, the smoke itself is a complex hazmat scene.
Exactly. So given the intense training and specialized gear needed just to enter a known IDLH chemical environment, think about this. How often are regular firefighters unknowingly entering a complex chemical soup, a hidden hazmat incident, at every single building fire? Are standard firefighting protocols enough, or should they maybe integrate more hazmat-style thinking about those toxic byproducts, even when there isn't an obvious chemical spill?
That's a really interesting question, something to definitely mull over regarding everyday safety and preparedness.
Absolutely. We hope this deep dive has given you that valuable shortcut to understanding the critical world of hazardous materials.